At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Sometimes covering this economy really is all about the data. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the first day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Oh, what a day this was for those inclined toward a data-centric view of this economy. First among headlines was something called the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index. PCE is the shorthand. It's the measure of inflation preferred by the Federal Reserve, as I think we've told you. And the word today from the Bureau of Economic Analysis was that prices were up 6% in October over a year ago. That's down from a 6.3% annual rate of increase in September. The October core number, that is less food and energy, of course, down compared to September as well. Now, channel your inner Jay Powell here and ask yourself, is that enough? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes stock of where we are.
There's no one piece of data that gives anyone a perfect understanding of what's happening with inflation right now. Economists have their favorite indicators, but those favorites can change. Lawrence Ball is an economist at Johns Hopkins.
The initial rise in inflation had a lot to do with the chip shortage that led to car prices spiking, the supply chain problems. Really, now it is a story about the labor market.
Because it's still tight. Outside of tech, companies aren't really laying people off. Jobless claims fell last week to 225,000. That's near the weekly average in 2019, pre-pandemic. To convince Ball that inflation is slowing, he needs to see unemployment increase.
I don't take any pleasure in saying that high unemployment is not a good thing.
But it might be necessary to bring down the cost of labor, which affects the cost of everything. Joseph Gagneau, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, is keeping an eye on rent.
That is a predictor for what the PCE will do down the road.
PCE measures how much people are spending on their current leases. Gagneau is looking at new ones. Those prices are promising. Zillow data show rental prices are falling in most major markets. Betsy Stevenson, an economist at the University of Michigan, is looking at all the data, but she's also taking a philosophical approach. Like, when will people go into the grocery store and stop saying,
"Wait a minute, what happened to the price of carrots?"
She doesn't think we're there yet. And she says, even if inflation is slowing, we're nowhere near the finish line.
By the end of 2024, which sounds like a long way away, we should have inflation under 3%.
Oh gosh, I just got this flash forward of me like 2 years from now calling you up asking you the same exact questions.
And right, and I would say to you, Kristen, look, only a little bit of a ways to go.
I guess I'll see you back here in 2024. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Wall Street today. I guess traders were just wore out after all that buying yesterday, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. 8:30 tomorrow morning, Washington time, the November jobs report will be upon us, and we will not hazard a guess here as to what the number is going to be. What we will do, though, is ask an expert what she's going to be keeping an eye on.
So tomorrow, what I'm looking at is households in employer survey. I mean, the big numbers for sure.
Dr. Catherine Ann Edwards is an economist at RAND.
Unemployment, job loss, job change, any industries that look to be falling from the month prior. And I'm also looking mainly at the household survey because that's not telling us what businesses are doing. It's telling us what people are doing.
There are two surveys, the employer survey, which gets us the jobs added or jobs lost number in this economy. And then the household survey, whether people are looking for work or not, once we get the unemployment rate.
In that one, I'm looking for things like people who say they can't get full-time hours. I'm looking at absences from work, the number of people who say that they can't go into work because they're sick. That's also at record highs right now.
Pandemic's not over. In other words, Dr. Catherine Edwards at RAND. But look, one of the things the Federal Reserve is trying to do by raising interest rates is push up the unemployment rate. Maybe not a lot and maybe gently if it can, but fundamentally, people are going to lose their jobs because of what the Fed is doing. Maybe not directly, but the Fed raising interest rates with inflation at 40-year highs will be a contributing factor. So why isn't public sentiment toward the Fed at 40-year high as well? Marketplace's Matt Levin is on the History of This Economy desk today.
In the early 80s, Fed Chair Paul Volcker asked some of his staff to go around the country and tell the public why the Fed was raising interest rates to around 20%. Former Fed economist Donald Cohn met with a consumer advocacy group in Seattle. He doesn't remember the name of the group, but he does remember how they greeted him.
We entered into a series of boos. They made sure we understood the pain they were feeling. They actually started getting personal about our own personal finances.
With both unemployment and inflation around double digits, Cohn's message that short-term pain was necessary for long-term prosperity did not resonate. But at least he got an award when he returned to D.C.
These meetings were so unpleasant that Chairman Volcker awarded us Purple Hearts.
Fake ones, of course. Cohn says Jay Powell isn't getting booed everywhere he goes because the labor market is still pretty great. Plus, the idea that raising interest rates will actually lower inflation is now pretty well accepted.
I think there was a lot more uncertainty back then.
The Fed's approval rating is slipping. According to Gallup, only 37% of Americans think it's doing a good job, a lower rating than the FBI. Benjamin Dolchin heads the Fed Up campaign, a progressive group that wants the Fed to slow down rate hikes. He says more people would be angry with Jay Powell if they could understand him.
The Fed's magic trick is that they can hide in plain sight because they speak in jargon that, you know, that almost no regular human being speak.
So someone else now is taking the blame, says economist Philip Braun at Northwestern.
This time, it seems John Q. Public is really blaming the Biden administration.
And unlike his predecessor, President Biden has made a point of not blaming Jay Powell, fearing it would undercut the Fed's independence. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
As I said a minute ago, the November jobs report comes out tomorrow, one data point of which will be the number of people employed by public school districts in this economy. The last read we had showed just under 7.8 million people working in public schools. That includes bus drivers and cafeteria workers, as well as teachers. And as many as that may sound like on first blush, it's actually about 300,000 fewer people working in public schools than it was in February of 2020. So now a lot of districts with cash on hand from federal relief packages are looking to hire. And new teachers are figuring out what their jobs are really like in the wake of a pandemic. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that one.
It's 7 a.m. and 23-year-old Maria D'Angelo is in her car in New York City, waiting for street parking to open up outside the school where she's a student teacher.
Granted, there is a parking lot there that I could pay for, but it makes me wake up early to look for parking every single day.
D'Angelo, who majored in economics, is very budget-minded and first considered a job in finance.
I had to have an internal talk with myself and realize that, you know, you do love teaching. The money really doesn't matter.
D'Angelo starts her first job teaching pre-K in Queens later this month. She expects to make around $65,000. That's a bit higher than the median wage for elementary school teachers across the U.S., and more than double the median pay for preschool teachers. D'Angelo says, bring on the four-year-olds.
I'm confident in my stuff, and once I'm in the classroom, I just need to, like, let it happen.
There's a lot at stake early in a teacher's career. According to an analysis of pre-pandemic data by the nonprofit Learning Policy Institute, at least 19% of teachers quit within their first 5 years. Chad Alderman, the policy director at the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown, says a lack of good school leadership is part of the problem.
There's this adage that people don't quit jobs, they quit bosses. I think we see this in teaching as well.
Alderman says another thing districts could do is pay new teachers more and offer signing and retention bonuses. Though turnover, he says, is still similar to well-educated workers in other professions.
Teachers leave teaching about the same rate that nurses leave nursing and accountants leave accounting.
Which may actually be to districts' advantage. Knox County Schools in Tennessee just hired registered nurse Griffin Van to teach high schoolers about nursing. It's mid-morning, and she's in her classroom, where she just finished a lesson in CPR.
I'd been CPR certified for 20 years, but I'd never taught it until now. How'd I do, guys? Did I do okay? Yeah. Yay. All right. They said I did good.
As a nurse, Van worked a lot with adolescents and their families, and this summer made the decision to change careers. She likes having the same schedule as her two kids, who are 7 and 8, even though she took about a 15% pay cut in her new role, and is also getting her teaching license while working in the classroom.
I feel like it's going to take me a few years to really feel like I'm digging it, because right now I'm a student. I'm a student teaching students.
One of the things she's learning is how much things cost. Part of her job is to acquire medical supplies for her classroom. Prices for those have gone up 5.1% since this time last year, which feels
unbelievably high. You know, I'm used to working in a hospital where they kind of take care of it for you. Now I have to get on and try to find medical supplies for us to use in the lab.
In lots of ways, the responsibilities that fall on new teachers are changing. At Crawford Middle School in Lexington, Kentucky, 30-year-old Cameo Raglan, a new Spanish teacher, zooms from her now-empty classroom at the end of the school day. She says helping kids relearn how to learn and socialize in person is a lot.
Teacher tired is real, like tired to the point where you can't do anything but just cry because you're so tired.
But Raglan, who identifies as Afro-Latina and white and was a single mom, says she feels a connection with the kids in her class.
We really get each other, me and these hot mess express middle school students.
Raglan spent the last 2 years working for the National Education Association, a teachers union, and she eventually plans to work in education policy, she says, to address the system as a whole.
Not just like the students that I have and will have, but the students that I will never have, that I will never know, that live in states and in scenarios that I will never really know or be in.
In her current classroom, the loudspeaker has been interrupting Raglan, telling students and now her that it's time to go.
Alrighty, everybody, it is now general dismissal. Teachers, one more day. We got this.
Raglan says she tries not to take grading or lesson planning home to prevent burning out. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Absolutely. Kind of a shock and awe visual smorgasbord.
Honestly, I don't even know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 194 points today, a 0.5%, 34,395. The NASDAQ added 14 points, about a 0.1%, 11,482. The S&P 500 basically flat, closed at 4,076. Costco dropped 6.5% today after posting worse-than-expected November sales figures. Target dipped 1.2%. Walmart went the other way, picked up about 0.6%. Land's End tumbled more than 30% today, 30%. Chain posted an unexpected loss for the fiscal third quarter, and its revenue missed expectations. That's a no-no. Salesforce dimmed 8.25% today after announcing that its CEO, Bret Taylor, was stepping down. Yesterday, the firm did post better-than-expected third-quarter earnings and revenue. Bond prices went up. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, 3.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com. This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. So we talked about the big data release this morning from the Labor Department, PCE, which Kristen Schwab covered for us. Also, though, there were figures on personal income and personal spending. Income after inflation, to be clear, was up about 0.4% in October. Personal spending went up as well, 0.5%. So let's do a little math here, shall we, and try to figure out where that extra 0.1% people are spending came from. The answer may well be in a third statistic in today's report. The personal saving rate was down in October to 2.3%. The last time Americans were saving that little was 17 years ago. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on it.
There was a while there around the height of the pandemic when people were really building up their savings, partly because there weren't many places to go to spend money, and partly because of all that COVID relief. In April of 2020, the personal saving rate was almost 34%. But even before the pandemic,
U.S. consumers were saving around 8 to 9% of their income on a monthly basis.
Gregory Dacko is chief economist at EY.
Today, we're seeing the saving rate around 2%, which is an indication that consumers are increasingly struggling in the face of high prices and elevated interest rates.
Struggling, but still spending. People have kept buying things and going out to eat and traveling, even as prices have risen significantly. And Dacko says all that may be good for the economy.
But if we look at the source of income for their spending, that is not a sustainable source of income.
In other words, not only are people not saving much right now, they're also dipping into their existing savings to pay for things, including basic expenses. In a recent survey, Angela Fontes at the Financial Health Network says the nonprofit found a growing number of households are struggling financially.
We did see an increase in the proportion of households who said they weren't making their regular expenses, and a decrease in the proportion of households that said they had enough savings to cover 3 months of living expenses.
People are increasingly putting things on credit cards, too. According to a recent survey from Bankrate,
60% of people in credit card debt have had it for at least a year, and that's up 10 percentage points from last year.
Ted Rossman is an analyst at Bankrate.
Savings is being eroded, debt is going up. A lot of people are close to the edge, unfortunately.
The saving grace right now, Rossman says, is that for all the high-profile layoffs lately in tech and media, overall, the job market is still strong. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
All right, so let's talk about the Netherlands for a minute. Not their soccer team, which will face the Americans on Saturday morning to start the knockout rounds. Let's talk food and agriculture and how the Dutch have become a European production powerhouse and the food tech envy of many. Laura Riley is the business food reporter at the Washington Post. She wrote about what the rest of the world might soon learn from that tiny but mighty country. Laura, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So this is a food story, yes, but really it's a technology story. It's a crazy technology of food story.
Absolutely. Kind of a shock and awe visual smorgasbord.
Well, tell me how you came upon this story, because we should say up front, you know a little bit about food. I mean, you've been a professional chef, you've got awards and all that jazz, and here you are now reporting on it. What got you on this story?
Well, I was riding the coattails of this fabulous Dutch photographer, Kadir van Huizen. But he was looking at how this very tiny European country is the second largest exporter of agricultural products by value in the world, behind the U.S. So, you know, they're doing an awful lot of animal raising and vegetable production and seed production on very little land.
Yeah, we should be clear here. It is across the gamut of ag, right? It is livestock. It is ornamental vegetables and seeds, as you said. It's everything that they're doing. And they're doing it on, not to be pejorative here, a relative postage-sized stamp of land.
Yeah. You know, half of the land in the country is devoted to ag. But an interesting thing is about 24,000 acres, so about double the size of Manhattan, is under glass, is greenhouses. I mean, there's this, if you've ever flown over the northern part of the country, not that far from Amsterdam, it looks like something out of Blade Runner, you know? It's just these, like, incredible vistas of sparkling glass, you know? So a lot of what they're doing is what we call now indoor vertical, or, you know, there are a bunch of different terms for that. Mm-hmm. A lot of what they're doing also is developing the technology that can be exported to other places. And what's great about that is that it can make the farms close to where the people live and in parts of the world where there isn't arable land.
Yeah. And big multinationals are going over there to learn how to do it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's an awful lot of interest right now in upping our game in terms of technology, a lot of VC money in food tech right now. But some of what the Netherlands is doing is more kind of old school regenerative ag, or, you know, minimizing waste, minimizing water use. So it's very kind of climate friendly, high tech ag.
Say more about that, right? Because among the other things that they're doing is they're doing all of this production without increasing natural gas use, without increasing CO2, reducing fertilizer use, all this stuff that, you know, is going to be key as we try to deal with a warming planet.
Sure. So they're huge producers of onions and tomatoes, and they can produce a pound of tomatoes requiring only half a gallon of water. And the average globally is 28 gallons. So you're seeing a real discrepancy
there. Say that again. That's wild.
Yeah. So average over the world is 28 gallons of water to produce a pound of tomatoes. In the Netherlands, it's a half gallon. So none of that water is wasted. And the irony is that, you know, a generation ago, they had a terrible reputation. They were just these hard bullet balls that no one wanted to eat. And so they've really kind of changed their reputation, and not just on the vegetable side, but also on animal ag. So chickens, beef, pigs, they're huge exporters now, the biggest European exporter. And a lot of those ribs come to kind of middling chain restaurants in the United States. So you've probably, I'm not going to name names, but you've probably eaten some of them unbeknownst to you.
Look, I mean, you got to use a whole animal, right? Let me ask you this. You have certainly driven up and down California's Central Valley, right? And seen all the agriculture there, yes?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So how long do you think it's going to be, given big ag in the United States and how entrenched it is? And I say that not pejoratively, right? There are many pejorative things you can say about it, but it's a fact that we have large industrial scale agriculture in this country. How long do you think it's going to be, or will it ever be, that American agriculture becomes even close to what Dutch agriculture is, do you think?
I think it's imperative.
We've had a lot of failures of some of these big indoor, kind of high profile indoor vertical farms. And some of that is just because the startup costs are so prohibitive. Mm-hmm. But once we kind of, you know, amortize those initial costs, there's a lot of reason to think that it will be much more efficient. And also as LED light, you know, bulb technology increases, it will get less expensive to farm that way and certainly require a lot less water.
Yeah, the light in some of those shots, some of the pictures in this article was kind of wild. All right, you are a woman who knows your way around food. You're a trained chef. You've been doing this for a very long time. I have to believe that you tasted some of this produce over in...
I think that for leafy greens and for herbs, I taste a difference. The big kind of infighting has always been about nutritional density. Certainly dirt farmers have a little bit of like stink eye about whether this stuff is quite as good for you. We need some people without skin in the game to do some more of this testing. Yeah. But certainly for leafy greens and for herbs and those kinds of things, growing it right adjacent to where people consume it is a lot smarter than trucking it 3,000 miles.
Laura Riley. She's a business and food reporter at the Washington Post. Kind of a wild article. Lots of pictures of what they're doing over in the Netherlands. Laura, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your expertise.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
This final note on the way out, Janet Yellen went on the Colbert Show last night, and Colbert asked the Treasury Secretary about one of the perks of her job. Her signature is going to go on the money.
Did you practice? Did you practice your signature? Are you happy with it?
I practiced and practiced. You know, I had heard stories. Two of my predecessors, President Obama's Treasury Secretaries, Tim Geithner and Jack Lew, signed the currency, and their signatures were so illegible that people made fun of them. And Secretary Lew, he signed in something that looked like eight circles that were connected.
I remember that it looked like how a child would draw smoke coming out of a chimney.
Something like that. And for both of them, it was decided that they should redo it. And so I knew that this was something you could really screw up, and I wanted to get it right. And I practiced and I practiced, and you'll see what you think. But I think you'll be able to read the letters.
I'll do my critique on air. How about that? I'll let you know about it.
All right, here's your moment of economic context as we leave you for the day. A quick update on the price cap on Russian oil that Europe and the United States are trying to engineer. The Wall Street Journal reports today the European Commission has asked the 27 European Union countries to set that cap at $60 a barrel. Lots of other countries have to buy off on that, of course. The global benchmark today, should you be curious, Brent North Sea crude, $87. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.